This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen by phone calling 716-748-0144. Or if you have a computer or smartphone, go to bbsradio.com, navigate to station 2, and click on the listen icon. You can also participate during the show with calling questions for our guests. Toll free USA and Canada, 888-429-5471. Tonight's guest, Brandon Martinez. He is a writer, a journalist, an author from Canada who specializes in foreign policy issues and international affairs of the 20th and 21st centuries. For years, he's written about Israel, Zionism, Palestine, the American and Canadian foreign policies. Tonight, he's here to talk about his new book, The ISIS Conspiracy, and how Israel and the West manipulate minds through fear. He's also written two other books, The Grand Deception and The Hidden Story. You can get Brandon's books on Amazon.com or Create Space. Brandon, welcome to The People Speak.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's good to be here.
No, it's a pleasure having people that are well-informed on. Brandon, tell us about your new book.
Well, the new book is called The ISIS Conspiracy. And this is like my second book, Hidden History. It's an anthology, so it's a collection of essays and articles that I've written, you know, over the past 6 months. I would say this new book comprises my op-eds over the past 6 months. You know, I've written for Press TV, Veterans News Now, and other alternative media outlets, and my focus has always been, you know, geopolitics, international affairs, foreign policy. So I'm an opinion writer at heart, and so I tend to try to keep up with current events and analyze it and try to give people historical context and just try to cut through the lies and the deception of the mainstream media and of government and politicians who are, you know, consistently and regularly deceiving us about what they're really doing. And so I've collected all these articles that I've written about specifically the ISIS development, because this is a, you know, a huge thing in the mainstream media. We're inundated day and night with ISIS scaremongering, ISIS fearmongering. They're going to get us. This is the new boogeyman. You better watch out because they're going to come and kill you. We got to go there. We got to defeat them before they come here. That's the new story. That's the basically a regurgitation or a rebranding of this Al-Qaeda threat, which was the old boogeyman, and they've just given it a new name and a new face, and that's what this ISIS group amounts to. And so I've been following geopolitics for many, many years, probably upwards of 6 years, and you know, I've studied the actions, activities of intelligence agencies and how governments utilize terrorist groups for political objectives and economic objectives. You know, governments and states are the biggest producers of weapons. They have all the expertise in military and, you know, guerrilla warfare and all those things. So you cannot have, you know, an organization like ISIS that just springs up out of a hole in the ground and, you know, comes to such prominence in Iraq and Syria, in two major countries in the Middle East, with nobody helping you, with no people behind the scenes who are guiding it and manipulating things. So, you know, that's the mainstream media narrative, though. The mainstream media narrative wants us to believe that ISIS has no government support anywhere, that they just, you know, accrued all these weapons and got all these fighters on their own accord, and there's nothing more to it. This is, of course, a fabrication and a manipulation of reality. We know from you know, back in the 80s, from the establishment of Al-Qaeda, this was a manufactured creation of the CIA, and they used Al-Qaeda as a mercenary army to depose the Soviet puppet regime in Afghanistan. So that's the model. The model is when there's a government that Washington doesn't like, and it's not only Washington that does this, but Washington is the principal power in the world today, so they're the worst offender in this respect. But when there's a government that Washington finds itself at odds with economically or politically, they will finance and fund terrorist groups, insurgencies, to cause problems for those regimes and ultimately to depose those governments and replace them with governments that Washington is more favorable to. So that's the model, and it seems to be playing out over and over again. You know, history likes to repeat itself. So we had that operation. It was called Operation Cyclone, where the CIA funded terrorists to cause problems for the Afghani government because it was under Russian influence. This induced a Soviet invasion, and then you had that Soviet-Afghan war for 8 years, which was basically incited by the United States. But with the Middle East today, you know, things are developing rapidly with this whole ISIS takeover of certain areas in Syria and Iraq. But it didn't start with Syria. You know, about a year ago, and even 6 months ago, the mainstream media didn't say a word about ISIS. There was nothing in the media that you could point to that identified who these people were and what these people wanted. And the reason for that, as I elucidate in the book, is because the West's foreign policy agenda from the get-go, from day one, was to remove the government of Bashar al-Assad in Syria. It has nothing to do with fighting terrorism. The West, you know, basically you have to look at it, you know, whatever the West is saying, they're usually doing the opposite. So the politicians say one thing and they do the opposite. So they say that they're against terrorism and they're fighting terrorism, but they're actually funding the terrorists, right? And that's just the typical duplicity and double game that these governments play. But with ISIS, we go back to the Libya invasion, right? Before the Syria crisis began, you had the war in Libya. This is the NATO war in Libya. And what was the narrative then? The narrative is that the rebels were the good guys, that the rebels are trying to depose a dictator, that we should support them, and that they deserve our airstrikes and all the help that we can give them. And this is what the West did. They financed those rebels in Libya. They gave them weapons and training. They aided and abetted the rebel takeover of Libya with airstrikes, with the NATO airstrikes, and facilitated the deposing of Gaddafi. The goal was regime change, as it always has been since 9/11, regime change. And you do regime change either by outright invasion, as the U.S. did with the war in Iraq with Saddam Hussein, or you simply fund terrorists to do it for you. And so we have to understand that this is just a developing story, and that the modus operandi is always the same. So the West funded the rebels there in Libya. They were well known to be al-Qaeda groups and al-Qaeda franchises that were the brunt of the rebel force in Libya. And basically those radical groups were armed by the Gulf regimes, you know, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others. But those regimes are simply proxies of the West too, because, you know, we had this former U.S. general, his name is Wesley Clark. He came out recently and said, our allies in the Gulf funded and created ISIS. But what he's doing is he's giving you half the story. He's saying, yes, our allies funded and helped create ISIS and give them weapons, but who told them to do that? Those governments don't operate independently. Saudi Arabia and Qatar are client regimes of the United States. So Washington is the one who came up with the policy and told them to do that and green-lighted those governments to start supporting these groups. It's sort of like this two degrees of separation gambit where they can say, our hands are clean over here in Washington. It's just our buddies over there in the Gulf that are funding these terrorist groups, when it was Washington to begin with that told them to do it and is working through those regimes. And this has always been the case. But with Libya, you had those rebels there. They deposed Gaddafi. They murdered Gaddafi, which was the policy plan from the beginning. You know, you had Hillary Clinton cackling about Gaddafi's murder, brutal murder. And those rebels, many of them, were simply taken from Libya, transported to Syria. These are foreign fighters. These are basically professional killers and mercenaries that Washington and other Western governments use and transport them wherever they need them. So if they need them in Libya one day, that's where they'll be. If they need them in Syria, that's where they'll be. And that's where they are today. And that's what this whole fiasco has come to in Syria and Iraq.
Well, anybody with a half a brain would figure out that regime change has been the thing. Even with the false flag of the chemical weapons on Syria, which turned out to be completely false, and we see videos of people acting it out, and right. Also Libya. Before they even did that, they had already taken over the governments of the Gulf states by putting them into economical situations that they couldn't get out of, and they're indebted to the United States and the banker corporations.
That's so, right, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
this actually started. This started before the first Gulf War. This is when this all started. Whether it was foreign or domestic terrorism, the plots were all the same, and their hands were in it, trying to change not only foreign policies but also our domestic policies here, as far as the Constitution. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely, there seems to be a two-tiered purpose for terrorism, right? So they cultivate terrorism abroad and use it for their own purposes, such as regime change in these countries. But then on the home front, you know, we've seen it time and again, these governments use the fear of terrorism to basically trick the public into consenting to the extirpation of their civil liberties, right? So you have the Patriot Act, which was written before 9/11, already on the table. They just took it off the shelf and implemented it after the 9/11 attacks because that was the event that was needed to convince the public that, yeah, we need to give the government and the intelligence agencies more power to protect us from the terrorists, right? I mean, this is the standard textbook strategy of the governments. It's not just the United States or any of these other Western governments. They're the most powerful governments today, but it's across the board has been the number one modus operandi of tyrannical governments is to use the fear of terrorism, the threat of terrorism, and use it to control your own people, right? But even if you look at the statistics of terrorism, you're more likely to die from in the West. You're more likely to die from getting hit by lightning or tripping in the bathtub or dying of an allergic reaction than you are from terrorism, right? So it's a false fear. It's just a manufactured threat. It's not an actual, real existing threat that we should be scared of. You're more likely to die in a car crash. Well, are we going to ban cars because that you could die? I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, this idea that terrorism is some significant threat to the West is a fantasy that's used by governments, of course, to take away civil liberties. And with this ISIS thing, it's just the same stuff over and over again, right? Because I'm here in Canada. And right now the government has on the books a new bill. It's called Bill C-51, and it's basically a clone of the Patriot Act. I mean, it's so absurd because, they have these new bills and are constantly trying to push this new legislation through the parliament, even though they had already passed similar type anti-terrorism bills before. Like right after 9/11, the Canadian government passed an anti-terrorism bill and gave more powers to the security agencies, and it's just basically a consecutive power grab, right? It's concurrent, continuous power grab where they just scare you with the fear of terrorism and then offer the solution in this new bill that's going to save you, right? It's a ruse. It's a racket. It's just a scam. It's a power grab. And this new bill in Canada, Bill C-51, is absurd. It's ridiculous Orwellian Stalinist law that basically gives the intelligence agencies carte blanche to spy on you, to arrest you, to detain you without charges, without evidence. It is pure tyranny. And they're even suggesting now that terrorist propaganda and defending terrorism, quote unquote, whatever those things mean, is against the law according to this new bill. So they can interpret that any way that they want to. They can say, oh, you're against the government's foreign policy. That means you support terrorism. We're going to arrest you, right? It's just pure tyranny. And, it's, you know, a lot of people are making a big deal about this in Canada right now.
Which also made me wonder why they never, you know, get Monsanto or any of these big pharmaceuticals that are terrorizing people medically. You know, Right. That's... They're willing to go after these foreign terrorists, but we're being terrorized, and they're allowing it. There's all kinds of things that they're doing to us here in the United States, but we also forgot to mention what preceded the Patriot Act, and that was the Domestic Terrorist Act. That was the start of it.
Right. It's basically just a continuous process where they stage an attack or they stage a shooting. And then they give you the legislation that just gives the government more power, and you know they claim that they're fighting terrorism. They're absolutely not. They're sponsoring the terrorists. There was a story recently in Canada that proved CSIS, our intelligence agency, was working with a guy in Turkey who was a liaison for ISIS, and he was funneling these British schoolgirls to become sex slaves for ISIS, and he was transporting them through Turkey to Syria. And this man was literally in the pay of the Canadian Intelligence Service. And this is sort of a big scandal here in Canada, but it just gets swept under the rug every time, right? So our government's on the surface say, we're fighting these people, we're at war with this group, and then covertly and clandestinely, they're funding it, they're training these people, they're helping them, they're working with them, and are using them, of course, for the ultimate goal, which is to overthrow Assad, and then ultimately after that, go after Iran. You know, it's amazing, and I always point this out, is that ISIS, you know, it claims it's this Islamic organization. It claims it represents Muslims. All they do is attack other Muslims. And funny enough, the only countries that they go after and have gone after have been countries that the West also wants to see destroyed. And Israel also wants to see destroyed. You know, the countries like Syria, Libya, Lebanon, and Iran, it seems to be the next target. Right. Those are government, right?
The expansion of Greater Israel is what the main focus is, and I believe that wholeheartedly that the Zionists are behind this one world dictatorship or tyranny that they're planning on going on. You're listening to The People Speak with Rock Cash and Brandon Martinez, coming to you live on the BBS Radio Network. What are your thoughts about Israel? Let's go into them a little bit, since they seem to be the driving edge for all of this.
Absolutely, and you know, a lot of people shy away from the Israeli issue because they're scared of being called anti-Semitic or whatever. I mean, these are smear tactics to distract from the truth and the reality of Israeli malfeasance and Israeli geopolitical scheming in the region. You know, when we talk about the Middle East, you can't really talk about it without talking about Israel, because it's in the heart of the Middle East. It is the military superpower of the region. It has nuclear weapons. It wants to subjugate and subdue its enemies and, you know, create this little mini imperium for themselves there, using the West sort of as a battering ram against their enemies. So it's impossible to separate the West from Israel. It's basically one continuous thing, you know, with groups like AIPAC basically telling the U.S. Congress what to do. People like Netanyahu going to the U.S. Congress and giving obscene speeches and bossing the president around. I mean, it's pretty obvious who's running the show in Washington today. So when we talk about ISIS and all these geopolitical happenings in the Middle East, we can't separate it from Israel, because when you look at the fundamental policy plan and scheme for the region, it goes back to the Zionist strategy, which was outlined probably, you know, back in the 50s. This was a conception that the Zionists had, but it wasn't fully implemented until and talked about openly until probably the 1980s. So you see in 1982, there's this document that very infamous on the internet now. It's called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. It was written by a guy named Oded Yanan, is an Israeli, you know, Likud zealot and geopolitical strategist for the Likud party there. And he writes this document basically outlining a scheme for the fragmentation, fracturing, and ultimately the destruction of all of Israel's rivals, military rivals in the region. So when they talk about threats, this country's a threat, that country's a threat. Well, threats are, you know, dependent on who's, you know, who's looking at it and who's determining what the threat is. For most people in the Middle East, Israel is the main threat. Israel has all the military hardware, the nuclear weapons, is constantly saber-rattling against its enemies. So Israel is, of course, the main threat to stability and peace in the region. But according to Israel, Iran is a threat, or Lebanon is a threat, or Syria is a threat. Basically, they view everybody as a threat other than themselves. So he laid out in that document, you know, using religious and ethnic conflict within these countries, because there's so many different ethnicities and religious groups within the Middle East. He advocated kind of stirring up ethnic hatred and religious tension in these countries and sort of pitting them against each other. And this was a strategy that Israel actually implemented to a T in Lebanon back in 1982. Israel invaded Lebanon and armed radical Christian militias, the Falangis, who then carried out on the Israeli orders the Sabra and Shatila massacre. So Israel has always, you know, intended to divide and conquer the region for decades, right? It's just they couldn't really convince the West to do it for them, you know. So it took them a lot of years to finally get these Western governments on side with this agenda. But, you know, you follow their writings and you follow their, you know, their strategy. And what they've openly said is their strategy. You go from that Oded Yanan report to another report in 1996. It was called A Clean Break. It was written by several neocon Zionists, principally Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, and David Wormser. All three of those guys went on to become high-ranking officials in the Bush administration, setting the policy for the Iraq War, leading the drive for the Iraq War alongside Paul Wolfowitz, who's another Israeli citizen and neocon who was influential in the Bush administration. So they write this Clean Break report calling for basically the same thing as Oded Yanan. They say we need to confront our opponents, confront our enemies. They call for a proxy war against Syria, for example, which we're seeing today in the form of ISIS. They call for cutting off peace talks with the Palestinians. They call for removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq as a precursor to the attack on Syria and Iran. Right, they basically laid out everything that has happened since that time. So when you take that report, you look at who wrote it, you see that those people went on to become high-ranking officials in the Bush administration, the Pentagon people who came up with all the lies and the propaganda about weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein and all this stuff. All of those lies came out of the Pentagon, out of this group called the Office of Special Plans, run by Douglas Feith, who co-authored that report, and Abram Shulsky, another Zionist neocon. So the war in Iraq, from the get-go, from the beginning, was always the Zionist policy plan, but it was just sort of like the first step in a series of regime change policies and conspiracies in the region. So you have Wesley Clark, who's this U.S. general. He came out and said that the plan after 9/11 was to destroy 7 countries in 5 years. All those countries are enemies of Israel and happen to be basically being toppled today as we speak, one after the other. So they are following this policy plan. 9/11, of course, the catalyst for that, the casus belli, the useful, convenient pretext that was seized upon by the neocons to implement all these ridiculous foreign policy adventures, which we see unfolding today. And my first book, Grand Deceptions, it deals with the Iraq War and the Zionist role in it, but it also goes into 9/11 and how false flag terrorism has been sort of an art form for the Israeli state from the beginning. You know, when we go back to the founding of Israel back in 1948, a few years after World War II, these terrorist groups, like the Irgun and the Stern Gang and the Haganah. These were Zionist militias that formed in order to try to push the Arabs out of the region to create the Jewish state. And they used terrorism, and specifically false flag terrorism, such as bombing the King David Hotel in 1946, which was a false flag attack. They dressed up like Arabs. They've admitted to this and bragged about this in a British documentary. They said, "We dressed up like Arabs and blew up the King David Hotel," which was the British command center at the time. So they were waging an insurgency against the Arabs to ethnically cleanse them, but also against the British, because they didn't want the British there either. They wanted their own autonomous Jewish state. So from the beginning, they've been using false flag terrorism, sort of pitting the West against their enemies, right? That's what we see today with this neocon clash of civilizations. You know, all of these terror attacks in the West, for the most part, are engineered, concocted by the Israelis and their loyalists in the West, and corrupt elements in the West that they've hijacked. So most of these attacks have been engineered, have been fabricated by the intelligence agencies. You know, there's a few different ways they can do it. They can either do it directly themselves. If it's too complicated and sophisticated for just some dupe to pull off, you know, they have to actually execute the attack, and that's when it's a pure false flag. But it doesn't really matter if it's a let it happen or a made it happen, because a let it happen, you still have the connivance of the government. You still have to, you know, basically clear the path for these people to do it. So that's pure treason. So it doesn't really matter. But there's different types of false flags. But you know, even letting it happen, they basically, as the FBI has been shown to be doing, they infiltrate groups like a mosque, and they have an informant try to radicalize people, right? They'll prod people. They will push them to commit violence. They'll try to sniff out the radicals, give them everything that they need to carry out attack, let them carry out the attack, and then you know, claim, oh, we need more resources to be able to stop stuff like this. It's a pure propaganda thing. It's a pure deception, right?
Yeah, well, that's the way it always works. Wow, this is going by pretty quick. We need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with our guest, Brandon Martinez. Be right here on The People Speak. We'll see you in a few minutes.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer, and this is the great BBS Radio.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
This land is your land.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
Welcome back to The People Speak. This is Rock Cash coming at you live on the BBS Radio Network with our guest, Brandon Martinez, author of The ISIS Conspiracy, The Grand Deception, and also The Hidden Story. Brandon, I've got questions from our guest. Mike in California agrees with you a lot, and he also agrees with your views, and he wants to know what your solution for America is, an uprising, economic, political, physical, or is it too late?
Well, that's a tough question, especially for somebody like me, because, you know, I'm a geopolitical sort of analyst, and I kind of look at history and try to draw parallels. But I haven't really decided exactly, you know, what is the best solution. I think, you know, there's various different camps, political camps, that offer solutions to what the present day America is, with this sort of tyrannical federal government that is causing all these problems. So, you know, there's like libertarians would basically say that, you know, you shut down this military industrial complex, you know, end the Federal Reserve, and, you know, things of that nature. And I would agree with those things and say that, you know, anything on that track is beneficial to the current scenario. You know, if it just continues on this ridiculous war path and financial depravity as we see coming out of Wall Street, you know, it'll just get worse and worse. So something has to be done. I don't know exactly what it is, but I think just scaling back the federal government at the very least is a step in the right direction.
Good. Reginald in Maryland wants to know, Brandon, what's the latest news on the School of the Americas where they train many of these foreign terrorists?
I guess that's in Latin America where that's based, sort of like a CIA training camp for various rebel factions that they've used as bludgeons against Latin American governments, such as the one in Nicaragua during the Iran-Contra scandal. I don't know the exact status of that particular school today or if it's still functioning. I assume it is. It sort of hasn't been catching very many headlines because the United States has focused its attention mainly on the Middle East now and hasn't been meddling too much. They have been meddling in Latin America. Somewhat Venezuela recently claimed that the U.S. has tried to orchestrate another coup there, as they're always doing. So I don't know the current status, but I'll keep my eye out on that.
Right. Carl in Illinois wants to know, have you been able to trace any arms shipments to ISIS back through the Benghazi and Libya? Did the Ambassador Stevens discover something he should have not about it?
I think there's certainly a connection there. You had Seymour Hersh, a pretty prominent journalist who wrote a piece back in, I think it was 2007, something like that. And he was trying to talk about how they're going to start something with Syria, and the U.S. was basically smuggling weapons to rebels. But he also unveiled, you know, something to do with how Benghazi was sort of like a transit point to ship weapons to those rebels in Libya, of course. And I think, you know, that CIA station there and then that ambassador had something to do with it. And somehow those weapons ended up in the hands of ISIS in Syria. So, you know, what is the story there? Maybe the ambassador was going to blow the whistle at some point and then they had him taken out. It's hard to say exactly because there's so much murkiness surrounding that incident. But definitely it was a weapons smuggling area. The CIA has its dirty fingerprints all over that, and you know, a cover-up has been implemented here. So anything these politicians are saying about exposing the truth about Benghazi, they're lying.
Right. As you know, we're heard around the world. So we've got Mike in Liverpool, and he wants to know, after years of studying this, how optimistic are you that the general population waking up to this and being able to reverse the course and create a world that we could all live in?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of optimism, you know, it's hard to be that optimistic at this point with so much negativity happening, and you know, these governments seem intent on just carving up the world the way that they want to see it, and you know, just not even caring what public opinion is anymore. It's like these politicians and these governments, they're so brazen in their deception and their duplicity, and you know, even though large segments of the populations are waking up to this, you know, you see polls now suggesting that large percentage of Canadians and even Americans, Europeans, don't believe the official story of 9/11, for example, and most people have doubts about it. Governments don't really care, though, as long as they have a firm grip on power. They couldn't really care less about public opinion. But, you know, in history we've seen, you know, revolutions take place that start from the bottom down, you know, start from the bottom, just grassroots, organic things. And, you know, some people would say that change happens from the top up, but that's not always the case. You know, if people are determined enough to have their rights and to do away with corruption and duplicity and evil that manifests from their government, then anything can happen, you know. You know, human potential is unlimited. So it just depends how many people decide they've had enough of this or even understand what's going on and want to do something to change it. A big problem is that a lot of people are, you know, either scared or they're just, you know, consumed with entertainment junk to even know what's going on or care what's going on. A lot of people have been brainwashed and have been manipulated by the junk media out there to basically be apathetic to what happens in the world. As long as they're, you know, they can get their Netflix and their Xbox running, you know, that they're content and they don't care what happens in the world. But it's changing that apathy. That's the first thing we need to do, is try to, you know, convincing people that this stuff does matter, and it will eventually affect you. I mean, even though this craziness, most of the deadly craziness is happening overseas, right in the Middle East, where our governments are wreaking havoc, and you can't really feel it here, right? Because it's not in your face. It's not happening in our cities. So
right,
you know,
it's not a direct involvement.
Right, it's not directly affecting you. So you know, you think this is just never going to affect you, but it affects us too, because you know, as we've seen with these Orwellian pieces of legislation that they've tried to put forth to give the government more power. I mean, this is tyranny. You know, this is George Orwell's nightmare, you know, on steroids. So it will affect people at home. It is affecting them. I mean, even, you know, even if you don't think what's happening overseas affects you, it does in the form of, you know, economics, because our government spend, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, not billions of dollars, on military and defense and these foreign interventions that are immoral, first and foremost, and illegal. And they're not spending the money where it should be spent, which is in, you know, healthcare, education, and things like that. So it does affect you. And we see, you know, collapse in many Western countries. Like in the United States, there's many parts of the United States that are basically economically suffocated and have extreme poverty, right? So it does affect us. So I think people should become more engaged, and that's sort of the first step to change, is becoming aware, right?
Absolutely. And the ones that are the least affected by it and don't care and everything else, these are the ones that are going to be hurt the worst, because once they realize that everything that they've worked for and everything that they thought they can rely on is going to be gone, then they'll wake up and then they'll be pissed. But until that happens, once again, they're going to be living their conditioned lives.
Right. Ignorance is bliss, as they say. You know, I approach these things from you know, a moral perspective. You know, I oppose these foreign interventions not because it might affect me economically, but because it's fundamentally immoral for us to go overseas and bomb people and kill people for bogus reasons and for the interests of bankers, war profiteers, and foreign governments, right? So that's how I approach everything. I really have no interest in money or prestige or any of these superficial and artificial things that the powers that be kind of use the character flaws in people to manipulate them, right? But you know, for most people, it's just a sad fact that, you know, they will not really be encouraged to do anything unless it affects them directly or affects them economically, especially because there's such an emphasis on money, you know, worshiping money. The only thing in life is to get some great career and just, you know, line your bank account with money. So, I mean, this is part of this degenerate trash culture that they push, you know, through Hollywood and through the popular media, is to, you know, convince people that money is the only thing, that money buys happiness, when clearly that's not the case. When you have celebrities, you know, committing suicide and overdosing on drugs, it's clearly money and fame doesn't buy happiness and causes actually a lot of problems for people. Whereas if you didn't have that economic factor, those problems wouldn't be there. So, you know, I think there needs to be sort of a paradigm shift in terms of people's mindset and how they think about the world, in addition to, you know, understanding and coming to a realization that, you know, the politicians and the media aren't telling us the full story, right?
Right. People need to wake up and realize that power and greed really isn't the way out. It really isn't. You can be left high and dry without anything. And what will you do then? You know, these people are just completely conditioned by the media and television, and everybody wants to be like the Joneses. Well, this is how they control the minds of people subliminally, by making everybody think that it's a good thing to be at the status, and they have the different status levels. But this [S2] Right. [S1] all comes back to the pretty much the factors of the Zionist and the Talmudic rituals that are followed by these Zionists.
Yeah.
It's all about the destruction of the morals of humanity, more or less. And they started by bringing in socialism into the family and government into the family, to where you can't even reprimand your child or spank your child. Or I'm not an advocate of beating, but, you know, sometimes children need to know where their point is. You know, they can only go as far as they're allowed to go. And it's making it hard for families to keep their families united, let alone their communities and counties and so on and so on and so on.
Right. When you break down the cultural fabric and moral fabric of society, you'll kind of you'll make it easier for the population to sort of consent and get in line with and be able to be more easily corralled behind immoral foreign policies. You know, most people don't even think about foreign policy. They're totally just immersed in their own environment, their own community, their own world. But, you know, they have a general kind of idea that stuff happens in the world. Their government's involved in all these things. Like here in Canada, you know, Canada is always, you know, portrayed as this peacekeeper nation. You know, we're always keeping the peace everywhere. This is a pure myth, you know, pure fantasy. You know, most people just accept this at face value without looking behind the curtain and seeing all these, you know, obviously, you know, foreign policy is never motivated by what the politicians say, which is usually some flowery rhetoric about human rights and we have to save the women in Afghanistan, so that's why we're there, right? And then they're backing up some government that's even worse to women, right? So it's always economic and geopolitical in terms of foreign policy. That's the same with all governments. It's not even just the West. So I try to have sort of a balance where I, you know, some people fall into the trap of looking for saviors, right? They think, oh, you know, these governments are the worst offenders of the United States and Israel, so maybe Russia is going to save us from this, or maybe China is going to save us from this.
Well, they don't realize that these governments are all entangled. It's one big evil web.
Right. It's sort of just, you know, there's one gang and then there's a lesser gang. So let's jump in with the lesser gang because this gang's worse. But, you know, it's still a gang and it's still murderous, still criminal. In terms of, you know, looking to Russia to bail us out of some New World Order, I don't think it's going to happen. You know, basically that whole New World Order thing was established after World War II. That was basically the clincher there. You know, you had, these imperial governments, the United States, Britain, they got together with the Soviet Union and China, you know, in World War II. They were all allies. And, you know, I think it was Roosevelt who said, you know, or proposed that these governments, you know, the United States, Britain, Russia, China, would become like a global police force. You know, that he even suggested that they do that. So it's like I don't side with, you know, some country that's a lesser evil. I think it was Ayatollah Khomeini who said the United States is the great Satan, but he also said that the Soviet Union was a lesser Satan. So, you know, I don't agree with big powers, these forceful military behemoth governments dictating to smaller countries. You know, the smaller countries are obviously can be more principled because they don't have this power. You know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's why you see governments like Iran being very principled in supporting, you know, the truth movement. You know, Iran has conferences there where they let, you know, 9/11 skeptics go and voice their views, or let, you know, Holocaust revisionists go over there and voice their views, whereas Western governments jail people who question any aspect of the Second World War, right? Russia, even recently, Putin made a law banning any revisionist views concerning the Second World War. And of course he does that because Russia was part of the victorious powers of World War II, and they have a vested interest in maintaining the mythology surrounding the good war, right? The good war. And he plays upon that to gather support in Russia today. So, you know, I think that these are sort of lesser evils in Russia and China. Their foreign policy obviously isn't as bad as the West today or Israel. You know, the West and Israel have this very destructive foreign policy, you know, go in and smash up our enemies. Right, that they're just so brazen and brash with it, whereas Russia is kind of more subtle. Russia and China are more subtle with their, you know, atrocities. You know, they'll just bomb Chechnya back to the Stone Age, and nobody will notice, or China and Tibet. So there's different issues involved. I think Russia and the West today have sort of a parting of ways, just like in the Cold War, which was about 50% theater. You had, you know, the elites of these countries kind of just pretending to be enemies just to sort of bolster the military-industrial complexes of their various respective nations, right? So you have that today. They have some disagreements. So you have the West that wants to have its way with Syria and other Middle Eastern countries, but Russia says, oh, no, I have some military bases there. I have some economic interests there, so no, you're not going to go there. It's not that Russia has some concern for Syrian people or human rights or anything. It's pure geopolitics. It's pure, realpolitik. And you know, I try to avoid that. You know, these people get sucked into, like, siding with Russia because Russia's siding with Iran or Russia's siding with Syria. Russia's only doing that for its own interests. So I don't think it's a principled thing. I think it's just a, you know, geopolitical and economic thing. So, you know, I always approach it from, you know, a universal principle that, you know, people should live a life of dignity, and everybody has a right to live a life of dignity. Not, you know, we're like these economic cogs, and, like, you know, we're all just subjects of either this big government or that big government. You know, that's why we called our website Non-Aligned Media, because we sort of were inspired by, you know, the Non-Aligned movement. You had all these nations get together during the Cold War and say, we're not going to be puppets of the United States. We're also not going to be puppets of the Soviet Union. So you had this false dichotomy during the Cold War, right? So you either choose to be a puppet of America and extreme capitalism and the exploitation involved with that, or you become a satellite of the Soviet Union and have to live under communist tyranny. You know, it's a false choice. Both choices were, of course, controlled at the top by the bankers, right, the financiers behind the scenes, and they were just trying to sort of herd the whole world into two camps. But we can make our own policies. We can come to our own conclusions about politics and what the solution should be for, you know, social, economic, and political problems. We don't need some forceful, tyrannical military-industrial complex to decide that for us. We don't need to lean on you. You know, we can create our own solutions. We don't have to be puppets, and that's what the whole Non-Aligned movement was about, and that's why I named my site Non-Aligned Media, because we don't have, like, this narrow, you know, ethnocentric or political ideology that we're following. We kind of just have this one vision that, you know, we can resist tyranny, we can resist imperialism, no matter who you are or what part of the world, and avoid, you know, falling into these traps, you know.
Correct. The biggest oxymoronic statement that I have ever heard in my life is that we're fighting for our freedom. Well, why are we fighting for our freedom when we're already born free? The same people that want us to fight for our freedom are the same people that are oppressing us. So This is something that people just don't get, and they're not awake to it. They think that patriotism is something that's honorable and something that's, correct. But in actuality, you're going, you're fighting, you're killing for whom?
Right.
You're not defending your freedom. You're not defending your right that you were born with. You're just defending rights that they are allowing you to have or entitling you to have that you should have from the get-go, and nobody should be empowered above you. So this is a fallacy of humanity that people take up the nationalistic roots and take up arms to go fight other nations. They just can't get past the conditioning and the systemizing that they've been put under. And a lot has to do with parents not waking up. You know, people that have gone to war, you know, these should be the first people to come back and say, hey, you know, what did we really fight for?
But right, exactly.
The systemizing, the conditioning just runs way, way too deep.
You know, patriotism is always manipulated. You know, I'm not against someone having pride in their heritage or their country, insofar as you're not taking it too far and trying to glorify, you know, past actions of your government that were wrong. You know, you can take pride in the good things of your culture, your society, your country, but at least recognize the bad things and the negative things that your country, your government has done in the name of your country and your people, right? So, you know, you have, you know, of course, you know, these governments claim they're fighting for freedom. It's so funny because those soldiers who are brainwashed into fighting, into joining the military, and, you know, they're fed a bill of goods in terms of why they're over in some foreign land, you know, fighting a war. They say, oh, we're fighting for freedom. The funny thing is, it's the complete opposite of reality, right? Because not only are you not fighting for other people's freedom, you know, when you invaded Iraq, when those American troops invaded Iraq, you didn't fight for their freedom. You just fought to enslave them to the United States and Israel, right? You weren't fighting for your own freedom either, because you were being, while you were fighting, your government was passing legislation that basically took all your rights away. And gave more power, excuse me, to the intelligence agencies, to the NSA, to spy on you, to listen into all your phone calls, and for the government to basically run hog wild.
You're surrendering your rights. And with that statement, I need to, you know, bid you a fair night, Brandon. It's been a wonderful interview. We're going to have to do this again some other time. Unfortunately, the hour went really fast. Make sure you join us next week here live on The People Speak. Our guest will be, let's see.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. People, don't forget to go to Amazon.com and pick up copies of Brandon's book. And be sure to join us here next week. This is Rock Cash signing out here on The People Speak.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief of us, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.